Well, welcome everybody. This is another learning event. I can't believe that we're almost in March and at spring break. It seems crazy. So this learning event, RM101, is called Manage Risk in Rural and Remote Communities or Just Risk Management. And I'd like to acknowledge that I'm hosting the call and you are all joining me from the traditional territory of the Kwamundan First Nation and Tongass Watch and Council. So you might be interested to know that RM101, this one, is the first of three learning events that we have in our risk management series. And they were actually initially developed in the Yukon through the Recreation and Parks Association of the Yukon. And then our RPA shared them with Recreation North and we built them into learning events. But really what we found that the reason why this was important for RPA is that the concept of risk management is sometimes overwhelming. Often it's difficult to know where to start and how to tackle the issues or concerns that we have. And so all three of the learning events that we have, beginning with this one, are designed to help leaders in recreation or other settings fulfill their responsibility. So, and your responsibility really is to be careful with anyone who uses your facilities, which includes your outdoor spaces, or anyone who participates in your programs. So really, if you try and keep in mind that from a recreation provider perspective, it's people using your facilities and people coming to your programs that you owe a care to or a standard of care. So that's what this learning event will be about. And as slide five shows you, RM101 will encourage you to sort of value the process of managing risk in your community recreation settings. It will help you identify and assess the probability and severity of different risks, and we will introduce a process and tools to help you manage risk in five key areas. You may have seen in the slides, this learning event is informed by somebody who was an expert in the field for about 40 years. He's retired, Dr. Ian McGregor. So it's not just something that we've pulled off the shelf. It's something that is well researched and put together. So I think that you will find it helpful. And for those of you who have staff who work with you, I think you'll find it particularly helpful to have conversations with your staff too. So we're going to begin with a round of introductions as we always do. And I think while I was talking, I heard another beep. So I'm wondering if somebody joined the call while I was talking and who it is. Okay, maybe I didn't. So that's all right. So what I'd like you to do is we're going to do introductions and we have a very small geographic circle today because I'm just out past Bikini Gas Station and then we've got Carly and Eliza, I imagine you're at the Game Center and then we've got the other three of you at Kwamundan. So we've got a pretty small geographic circle. So we'll go around in our circle and in your small groups, just jump in with whoever wants to talk first. So what I'd like you to do is when you introduce yourself, I'd like you to share what I've called a sweaty palm issue. So a sweaty palm issue is something that makes you nervous because your little spider senses tell you that there's the potential for something bad happening. So I'll leave it up to you guys first to jump in and then and go from there. So again, this is Caroline speaking. Let's go to Eliza and Carly first. You can decide who wants to talk first. And if each of you could just introduce yourself quickly and share a sweaty palm issue that you have.
Hey, it's Eliza. So I think for me, one of kind of these sweaty palm situations is for us, one of our biggest events is kids triathlon. And that event has lots of moving parts. It also takes place within the facility, but also outside of the facility on the Mount Mac trails as part of the like outdoor where the bike and run section of the triathlon goes. So there's just a greater chance of risk, and also the demographic of like the age range of kids that we're working with is quite diverse, and all the way from like 5-6 year olds up to like early teens. So yeah, there's definitely lots of different types of risks in that one. And that one, as we're planning it, I always get kind of like nervous, excited at all the potentials that could happen.
I like how you say nervous excited. That sounds like a positive feeling. So very good. And you're exactly right. When you're using multiple locations, including the outdoors, and also when you have a range of ages with different skill levels too, that can really influence the risks that you might sense or experience. Thanks, Eliza. Carly, let's go to you, and then we'll go to Carolina and Nadine.
Hi, this is Carly. I missed the first bit of that intro, but if we're talking just what could be something that could happen during, I guess, anything. So I think when I was doing camps or when we were holding camps, the thing that makes me the most nervous is choking. Like anyone, if anything, there's food involved in any sort of event or program, that's kind of the biggest thing that I can't stop worried about. So for me, like, either I just rather have no food or I don't know. That choking has just always been the bane of my existence. And just any time there's food involved, especially if you're, you know, outdoors or if you take a group out on a hike, that's the one thing that scares me.
Yeah, and that's a really good example because you said, you know, it's something that's sort of more unique to you. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about is that we all have different sort of sensations around risk. We all have different concerns, and we all experience or interpret risk differently. And that's actually what makes risk management when you're in our programs a little bit more challenging. So thanks so much for sharing that, Carly. Let's go over to Kelly, Dana, and Nadine. Just if you could introduce yourself and share a sweaty palm issue that you have, something that makes you nervous because you sense something bad could happen.
Yeah, this is Casey. I'm with Quantum Dove First Nation Recreation Support Worker, and my sweaty palm is when we're working with poorly planned contractors. Sometimes you partner with people, and then if you arrive, especially when it's like an out-of-city limits place, and you get there and realize that the person that you partnered with or the organization has poor planning, and poor planning is what gets me nervous, especially with like outdoor activities and active activities.
Yeah, that's definitely something that came up in our PE 101 event and why we want to lay things out and have a work plan and things like that is working with people that don't quite do things the same way as you or might not have the same sense of planning can be pretty stressful. So thank you for sharing. Who's next? Who's next?
My name is Dana. I guess my sweaty palm is, I guess, like if we're outside and kids kind of get impatient and decide to take off ahead of you or ahead of the group. This has happened before, and it's just, like, very scary because, like, well, you don't know if they get too far ahead and you can't see them. Like, you don't know where they're going. You don't know, like, there could be a bear literally right around the corner. Or bugles or, like, all sorts of other hazards. And so trying to... Yeah, trying to manage that when you've also got kids, like, lagging behind is really stressful for me.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that because that actually brings in one of the key risk areas. So that's a great example. Thank you very much because this sort of spread out of kids when you're trying to manage them outdoors can be quite challenging. So thank you for sharing that, Dana. And who's next, then?
I'm Kelly. Sure. I also work for Palm and Dunn. I think I'll just follow Dina and Nadine have said. I think the study palms are those elements that are not necessarily in your control, so like weather, the contractors, the things that are unforeseen but kind of foreseen, but that you might not have complete control over and that they can go sideways quite quickly.
Yeah, thanks. So just sort of planning ahead for that. And as I mentioned, these five risk areas that we're going to look at will help you sort of foresee what could happen and plan accordingly. I think Lindsay's joined the call. And Lindsay, what we're doing is we're introducing ourselves and sharing a sweaty palm issue, which is something that makes you nervous because you sense something bad could happen. So I wonder if you'd like to jump in and introduce yourself and share your sweaty palm issue. Are you on the phone, Lindsay? I'm not sure. I can't hear. I'm not sure if you're on the phone, but I think that you said you're in the chat. I can hear you now, yeah.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
I can, yeah.
So my name is Lindsay Egger. I'm the corporate events coordinator for the city of Whitehorse. My sweaty palm issues are anything that happens at a shipyard park in the winter time. Generally, the events that I put down there get... in the past, pre-COVID, like thousands of people, and we get that amount of people in that smaller space, which it is small in that regard. It always stresses me out whether it's going to be a slip and fall, it's going to be a kid running into a dog or getting bit by a dog, it's going to be intoxication. There's so many things that it always keeps my palms pretty sweaty.
Yeah, so that's hard when there's more than one. So that's where I think this risk management learning event will help you guys look at where you really need to pay attention and where you just have to accept that level of risk, because there's a lot of different ways to approach risk. So thanks for sharing that, Lindsay. And I'm just going to come back. I was drawing a blank on sharing something with you, but I'll share something that Lindsay can relate to. When I first arrived in the Yukon, it was actually the work at the Key Hill and Watson Lake back a long time ago, and there's this old rickety ski bar, and my sweaty palm issue was when I was teaching kids to ski and getting them to use the ski bar in the first time, because this is before kids even wore helmets. So you can imagine a ski bar in the back of the head would not be nice. So that was kind of something that came to mind. But thanks so much for sharing, and keep in mind those sweaty palm issues. Because as you can see, especially like if you think back to Carly's example, we experience and respond to risk differently. So it's a very individualized response. I asked you to, in activity one, comment on how you feel about risk. And just so that you have an idea, nobody said they're unwilling to take risks or uneasy with risk, but nobody said that they like risk more than most people. Or that extreme risk is thrilling. So those of you who responded are kind of in the middle. Don't mind some risk, enjoy moderate risk, but nothing on the extremes. Often I'll have a group of people where I do have things on those extremes. So it's quite interesting to have conversations about risk. And it lets you understand that even if you work in the same organization or offer the programs together and work together, how you see risk might be different. And so planning to manage risk is really important. So although risk and types of injury might be unique to different situations, the process that we use to manage risk is one that we can use in many different instances. So if you had a look at the slides 8 to 14 and also activity 2 introduced you to three basic concepts. So one of those was foreseeability, which if you think foreseeability is simply being able to think ahead about what could go wrong. It also introduced you to risk rating, which is your ability to use your gut instinct, which is kind of what we talked about just now through our introductions, or actually calculate the risk using numbers. So we're going to talk about rating risk. And then it also introduced the concept of risk controls. And controls are things that you put in place to reduce risks. So, Dana, you mentioned like impatient kids, right? And some run ahead and some lag behind. So one of the risk controls that we might do is to have more supervisors with a larger number of kids. So that one can run ahead with the fast ones and one can stay with the slow ones. So there's different controls that we can put into place. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at a scenario together. That's where if you happen to have the risk management handouts open, that would be great. It's under the scenario review template. If not, no big deal. You can also look at slide 21. That's where I'm at already. Sorry, I just threw some dots today. I think we're going back and forth a little bit. But slide 21 also has that scenario review template on it as well. So I'm going to share with you a really basic scenario, and we're going to talk about what are some of the risks that might happen. And we're going to try and look at each of the five key risk areas. So here's the scenario, and we'll just go around in the circle. We'll do Eliza, Carly, and then Kelly, Dana, and then Dean. So if you even want to talk about it together and just one person talk, that's okay. And then Lindsay will include you in that conversation in our circle too. So imagine that you have 15 children in an after-school playground program. There's a youth supervisor. Unfortunately, that youth supervisor does not have first aid training. So we're going to think about what could possibly go wrong. I'm going to pop each one of these into the chat just to give you a little bit more here. So there's the scenario. I'm going to look at what could influence the chances of something bad happening. Which one of the key risk areas might we be concerned with here? What I'd like you to do then is to each of you identify a concern related to this scenario that also relates to one of those key risk areas. And the key risk areas are supervision and instruction, training, facilities and equipment, documentation, and emergency readiness. So I'll give you, actually I won't give you an example because I'll probably take some base idea away. So Eliza and Carly, between the two of you, what is one concern that you might have related to this scenario in any of those five key risk areas?
Hey, it's Eliza. I think the training and readiness. So if they know ahead of time, the program creator, the supporter, knows that the supervisor doesn't have first aid, then what's their plan or assessment process for dealing with if and when a first aid happens? So maybe they talk about some scenarios. Maybe it's like, you know, they have Band-Aids for just to hand out Band-Aids for kids. But if it's a bigger injury or accident that happens, what's their plan for that?
Great. So basically then what you're saying is there's two key risk areas that are involved in that. So not only the fact that the person doesn't have the first aid training, but what do you do, what's your emergency plan in the event that somebody doesn't have first aid training, but also if something big happens, what is your emergency response?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
So I think they could also plan their day with the equipment and the facilities to be less of a risky activity if they knew that their leaders don't have first aid. So maybe, yeah, just planning what they're doing so it's not so risky.
So would you mean perhaps like avoid climbing a tree in the playground if there's only one supervisor or something like that?
Yeah, or maybe don't go to the park or do more sit-down activities, things like that.
Great. So in other words, like if you just have one supervisor, they don't have first aid, plan what you're going to do accordingly. So have a good plan. That might come under documenting your lesson plan, your program plan, or under supervision and instruction, we've got lesson plans too. So that's great. Good suggestion. Thank you. How about over to Kelly, Dana, and Nadine? Anything that you can think of there?
Hi, this is Kelly. So we were discussing the ratio of supervisor to children is inadequate. And in a lot of places, I think people think there's usually regulations and requirements around ratios of supervisors to children.
That's right, and more so like in licensed places and things like that. But, you know, in my experience in some really small communities, it's sometimes hard to limit the number of kids who show up on any given day. So, you know, there might be preferable ratios, but it's nice to actually put those into a policy. So I imagine that probably you guys at Kwanlin Den, you probably have a policy around your ratio of children and youth to supervisors, do you?
Yeah, we do. We have different policies for the number of youth and then how many adults or supervisors or staff need to be there, and it's dependent on ages as well. And then with COVID, we also have different requirements so that we can space out as well.
Great. So that sort of demonstrates a very well organized program, right? When you have those types of policies, I imagine the Canada Game Centre, you guys would have that as well. But I have been in some communities where they don't have those because they just don't have the people to be able to supervise, but they also don't want to limit the number of kids coming or they don't do registration. So those ratios are as you pointed out, are really important. Kelly, Dina, and Nadine, is there anything else that you see as sort of a risk that might, or something that you'd be concerned about with the scenario?
Well, I guess it just ties back to training. It says one youth is supervising, but it doesn't define youth. And, like, a 25-year-old and a 16-year-old are going to be very different in their supervision capabilities. So a little bit of concern there, which I think just ties back into training and experience.
That's right, and that could come under also supervision and instruction, right? So sometimes you might, so I've seen programs that require one instructor or leader or supervisor needs to be a minimum age of such and such, and then other ones they can be younger than that. I think that's the case often in Nunavut communities, for example. Do you guys have something similar at Kwanlin Den?
So we have opportunities for youth to, like, take on, like, leadership roles, but they would never by themselves. There would be an additional supervisor that is, you know, either, like, the main facilitator would be in most cases or, you know, at least a backup facilitator. But, yeah, I mean, you don't really have minors supervising minors.
Yeah, and Eliza and Carla, you've got the same setup, right, at the Game Centre? You have programs where you have younger people, but they're always working with somebody who's got a little bit more experience, right?
Yeah, generally, in terms of camps, there would be, like, a camp coordinator, the camp leaders, and then sometimes there's, like, we have, like, youth volunteers, but normally they're paired up with a more senior staff.
Great, thanks. So that's a really good point. Kelly, Dana, and Nadine, did you have anything else that you wanted to raise from this before we go to Lindsay about the scenario, sort of some of these key risk areas?
Yeah, I guess it's not really clear in the scenario, but a concern would also be, like, especially if there's no adult there, maybe this youth doesn't have access to a vehicle, like, in case of emergency, like, what are the emergency procedures? Do they have a cell phone to contact someone who can take over if the situation gets out of control or, like, over their head? Having robust emergency procedures would be really important, especially if it's such a high ratio and abuse is in charge.
Exactly. That's great. So that communications, that laying out the plan so that you know what would happen in an emergency and also have those resources at your disposal. So, Lindsay, from your perspective, what sort of concerns might you have related to this scenario in the five key risk areas?
Thinking about parental sign-off and being informed with guardians and whatnot, like, do parents or guardians
understand the risks of putting their children in this after-school program? Have they signed off? Do they understand what that means? And on top of that also is, like, do we have information? Well, there's two things. Are we located in a place where maybe they're just outside the Canada Game Center and there's access, you can access the emergency procedures, emergency personnel within the building, but you're just, like, on the field outside. So, like, the location of it also made me think, well, what's happening there? And then do parents know what's happening at these programs? Have they signed off on it? Is there a waiver? Those are some of the things I started thinking about right away.
That's right. So that understanding or informed consent or parental consent is what we also call it, so that they understand what's happening and that they're informed. This is how it runs, and this is so, because that is an important part of running programs for children. Thanks for sharing that. The one other thing that comes to mind is we're talking about a playground, and there's actually a playground inspector course that people can take. It's a Canadian endorsed one. And so playground inspections are something that are a really important part of running a program in a playground. And so I'm kind of guessing that perhaps if this youth doesn't have first aid training, they might not also be experienced in checking out equipment. And if something sort of not working right and a child jumps on it, then what potentially could happen there too. So I also think of that equipment. And then, of course, the seasonal nature of running a program in the playground, right? The environment, like, is it cold outside? Is it warm outside? Are there bugs outside? Are there bears around? Those sorts of things. So as you can see, there's a number of different concerns. This is a pretty simple scenario compared to running on-the-land programs and kids triathlon and things like that. So it's quite simple, but you can see that you can raise and identify a lot of concerns in these five key risk areas. So I just wanted to touch on these five key areas. If you think about supervision and instruction, and now I'm flipping all the way back to slide number 10, so that's where I'm going back to if you're following along in the slides. So supervision and instruction, generally what you want to do is you want your higher risk programs, facilities, or people, they need to be supervised with people by specific qualifications. So in other words, you want to take the things that are a higher risk, whether it's people, facilities, or programs, and add higher expectations to them. So I'll give you an example. The best example we have in Canada of how risk management practices and standards have been put in place is actually aquatics. Aquatics is a great example. So if you think of swimming facilities and swimming programs, they all require certified lifeguards and instructors. So those are, technically there's a higher risk to running pools and running programming in pools. So that certification and those qualifications are important. If you have a higher skill-based or a higher risk activity, like gymnastics, or rock climbing is another one, you might need more supervisors. As you've mentioned, any kids' programs or camps need a slower ratio of participants to supervisors. And that, by that I mean that you need, like, one supervisor for four kids or one supervisor for six kids, something like that, not 1 to 10 or 1 to 15. And then if you have a playground where there's things like poor sight lines, like you can't be over the hill because the toboggan hill is right in the middle of the playground, it might need better supervision for that. The other thing to keep in mind here is related to instruction, and lesson plans are really, really important when the activity involves a physical skill development. So a learn to swim program should have documented lessons. That's a really good risk management tool. So those all kind of fall under this supervision and instruction. This is a pretty big area, probably the one you think about the most. If you go to the next slide, slide 11 is about the key risk area of training. And sometimes it's really easy to say everybody needs first aid training, everybody needs WMS training, everybody needs this. But sometimes that's really hard to do. So think of training as situational. So think of what you're doing decide on what type of training is needed for that situation or what is common accepted training, and then decide on who needs that training. So if you have three supervisors, you're doing an on-the-land program, maybe not all three need wilderness first aid, but maybe one does and the other two can have standard first aid. So there's, and I think that that helps you manage your training things, because it's really easy to say we're just going to train everybody and then you have no time to do your program. So there's a bit of a balancing here. Slide 13 or 12, sorry, is about documentation. And we actually have a RM102, a learning event, is entirely dedicated to documentation, because there's a fair amount of documentation that's related to your participants and how they participate in programs. And then there's also a whole bunch of documentation that's related to facilities and how you actually run your programs, so some of the policies. And the key thing to keep in mind here is that documentation shows that you're doing what you say you're doing. So the informed consent or parental consent needs to identify what the risks are or what your program looks like, and you need to make sure you do that, not change it. So documentation is a very important, it's very important. So if you're interested in RM102, that'll be in the fall, it covers all types of documentation, and then RM103 specifically covers waivers, because there's quite a bit of misunderstanding about waivers. On slide 13, you can see it says facilities and equipment. So there's a range of things here to consider, your inspections, your maintenance, checklists, like before you open a facility, you have a checklist, the signage that you have, like, you know, the one that comes to mind is the bathroom is wet sign. So you need to make sure that your facilities and your equipment are safe, and there's different ways that you can do this and document it. And then I think you've all mentioned the last key area, which is emergency response planning. So I imagine you're very familiar with the need to make sure that you have a plan in case something happens, and also to rehearse that plan. I think right from being children, our first thing is fire drills at school. So that's an example of having a plan in place and practicing it so that people know what to do when you're in that situation. And also, as you mentioned, things like we have to make sure that we have good communication, like the cell phone and backup communication in case the cell doesn't work. So I just want to take a minute to, or a couple minutes, to look at the first step in a risk management process. And then I'm going to ask you to sort of assess the probability and severity of something bad happening. So I'll just touch on a couple of these, the key points here. So if you go to slide 16, or slide 15 lays out the steps, slide 16 it starts. So the first step involves rating the level of risk for three things, and I've mentioned these three things before. I think it's really helpful for you in your areas to remember that there's three areas where you want to look at risk. Because sometimes we can focus in on our program or on our people and forget about the facility, or vice versa. So remember that risk happens in three different areas, programs, facilities, and people. And they might be different depending, like the same program with different people might have a different level of risk. So imagine running a drop-in program with 13 to 15-year-olds versus elders or, you know, preschool children, different risks associated with that. So what slide 17 shows you is that you can use something called your gut instinct, or you can use these zones of risk. And for any of you who've done any avalanche training, this is pretty similar to that. So it's the same sort of concept that I have a picture in my mind of the path and the avalanche zones and where to go and where not to go, and depending on it. So basically, we use our gut instinct and we look at two things. We look at the probability and the severity. So the probability is, could something bad happen? And the severity is, if it does happen, how bad is it? And so that's something that's important. And this one is really interesting to do as a team. So for those of you, say, working together, you know, maybe Kelly, Nadine, and Dana, it'd be interesting to put this as a chart on your wall and look at a couple of key risks and see if you all rate them the same or not, because this is where people's different sort of gut instincts come into play. So rating risk, you can also rate risk as a number. So when we have different sort of tolerances for risk, using numbers is sometimes helpful. So if you go to slide 19, you can see that you can rate risk using a scale of probability times severity. So you look at it on a scale of 1 to 5. And the handouts show you how to do this in more detail. But essentially, a 5 is really, really high, and a 1 is really, really low. So if you can see the example on this slide, a chess tournament, the probability that something bad will happen or someone will get hurt is 1. The severity if they do is 1. So the level of risk, T times F, is 1. Versus skydiving, the probability maybe isn't super high because of all the safety things, so maybe it's 2. But the severity if you get hurt skydiving is probably 5 out of 5, which gives you a risk rating of 10. So what you want to do then is, I just would like you to think this through, and you can do this with a piece of paper, or you can do it if you're sitting with more than one person, or Lindsay, I'm guessing you're on your own somewhere, so you can do this on your own. But I'd like you to pick something like an activity in your mind. It can be something that you done in your life and enjoy doing, or something that you do for work. So think about that, and then tell us what that activity is, and tell us what your risk rating is using this scale. So where 1 is unlikely or insignificant, and 5 is very likely that something would happen, what's the probability severity to give you the level of risk? So I'll pop that in the chat while you're thinking about it. And then we'll just start with Eliza and Carly again. So again, if you could tell us what activity you have in mind, it could be both of you together, that's okay. And then tell us what the probability and severity giving you the risk rating would be for that activity. So any thoughts, Eliza and Carly, on that?
Yeah, we were just actually talking about archery tag. So this is a drop-in program or a drop-in activity that we run.
Yeah, so I think the probability of something happening will probably be a 4. There's a lot of, like, running and shooting arrows. But I think the severity, because we have face masks and goggles and the arrows are blunt and foam, I think the severity would probably be like a 2. So that would give it a risk level of maybe 8 or 10.
Great. And so that falls into a moderate risk range then.
Yeah. And we make them sign waivers, I think, for that reason. It's the only drop-in they sign waivers for.
Is that an adult drop-in then?
No, it's I think it's 15 or 14 and up. So anyone under 18, I think, needs to have a parental signature. They can go by themselves, so their parents need to sign off.
Exactly. That's right. I like how you put that, because under the age of majority. So once you're considered an adult, then you can sign a waiver, but anyone who's a minor can't waive your rights as a minor, and a parent can't waive a minor's rights. So I'm glad to hear that you guys have that differentiated. That's great. Now, do you think if I just asked you to place the archery tag on the colored board that's on slide 17 with the red zone, gray zone, green zone, amber zone, what zone would you put it in, do you think?
Yeah, I would say the amber zone.
Okay, so the amber zone has a low probability but a high severity, so it might be the other way around.
Gray then.
Yeah, it could be gray. It might even be into the green if you're saying like 2 on a scale of 1 to 5. So probability of being high, a 4 would put it over into the gray zone. So exactly. So you can see it's actually kind of cool. If you're planning a whole bunch of programs or a whole bunch of activities, I did this in Dawson one time, and we put a big, huge chart of these zones up on the wall, and people use sticky notes to put where they thought things were. And then as you'll see next week, the ones that are at higher risk are the ones that you want to figure out what you can do, what strategies you can put in place to move them out of the red zone or high in the amber zone into a different zone. So it's kind of a fun, for those of you who work as a team, it's sort of a fun activity as you're planning your events or looking at what possibly could happen to use this and blow it up nice and big and put it on the wall. Thanks, Eliza and Carly. Kelly, Dana, Nadine, is there something that comes to mind for you, like an activity that you'd like to tell us about that you have assessed the risk using the probability times severity?
I'll just say the one that I did for my assignment. So I did cross-country skiing.
Mm-hmm.
And the risk zone I did gray. So I said depending on the level of individuals participating in the terrain, there's the possibilities for falls. And also weather is a factor. That could lead to, you know, cold or frost nip. And the low severity, high probability, and to mitigate this, knowing people's skill level. So if they're a bit more beginner, not taking them on steeper hills, and that will lessen the risk of falls. They might still, you know, tip over sideways, but the severity of it will be much lower. So risk zone gray, and then level of risk was 3 and 2, so low risk.
So it's 6 altogether, yeah.
And mitigate.
That's great. So can you... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if like the terrain is completely flat and there is no hills whatsoever, I would change the risk zone to green. So the gray would
be
some downhill, but if it's completely flat, I would change.
That's great. So what you've just explained to me is you're thinking about the risk in terms of your spaces and places or facilities, right? So you're looking at the terrain and the location where you're holding it. You're also looking at the individual, so the people. So, you know, is it a young child? Is it a timid adult? Is it an elderly person? Is it someone with lots of skiing experience? Is it somebody who's never been on snow before? But all of those things influence the risk, and that's around the people. So there's the facilities, the people, and then the other one is the program. So do you, you know, just let people rent skis and off they go on their own, or do you actually put them in a learn to ski or some type of program? So you can see how each of those three factors influence the level of risk and could shift or change it. And like you pointed out, you can make adjustments to each of those to reduce your level of risk. So that's great. Thanks for sharing that. Lindsay, how about yourself? Do you want to share like a shipyard park example or something? Maybe a specific, like, what is it, axe throwing or one of those ones that's going on during rendezvous? Or?
Actually, I was going to use one from my Ushi Crew Sister City Exchange program that we run with our sister city in Japan. It hasn't run for 2 years because of COVID, but it made me think about the loss or the theft of our participants' passports. So when they come over from Japan and come to Lakehorse, they have 10 days of fun. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, yeah, the probability of that is pretty good. Like, we've had it happen. So I've said that it's probably like a 3 or a 4, and the impact of the program is quite high. Like, it's not, you know, it's going to die from it, but it creates a lot of logistical issues and challenges with our Japanese students trying to go back to Japan. So I said it was probably a 4 as well.
Yeah, that actually is a really good point, because what you raised is that severity is about consequences. I know through a lot of this wording we talk about injury, but there's many, many other consequences that we have to be concerned with. So the consequence here is not being able to travel, not having the you know, the right ID to replace a passport, like extra costs, all those, and also damage to your program, right? So, you know, problems with your program could influence people wanting to participate in the future.
And then we also run into safety issues for those traveling back to Japan. So if we have a student that has lost their passport, well, they can't just stay in Canada by themselves, right? Like, the other students are still going to go back to Japan, and you have to look about ratios and costs associated with new flights and accommodations and getting the consulate in Vancouver involved. And, like, yeah, that's one of the sweaty palm ones.
Yeah, I'd be interested in you sharing that as your RLA because it gives a really good example of something that's not a physical injury. So if you feel like using that as your example for the both activities for this learning event, that would be great.
Okay.
Thanks. Well, that just made me think of one other question that I'd like to ask you just before we end the call, and it's related to consequences. So as Lindsay just pointed out, consequences are things that we have to be worried about or different types of risk, definitely physical risk, right, like physical injury. But let's just do an around the circle and see if we can come up with some of the other types of risk besides risk as in physical injury that we need to be concerned with. So Eliza and Carly, what's another type of risk besides physical injury to an individual?
Oh, that's a tough one.
What about like damage to like the reputation of the organization or business?
Mm-hmm. So can you give me an example of what you might have to be careful for or what might lead to something like that?
Yeah, I think like say I'll use like a fitness program for seniors. If you have staff that aren't qualified or certified to work with that aging population and then someone becomes injured in a way that was preventable with that training or that they would have a better understanding of how to work with that older population, then it could damage the reputation that we have with working with our senior population in terms of fitness. So.
Yeah, and that's a population that it takes time to build trust with, right, and rapport. And so once that's damaged, it'll take a while to rebuild it. So that definitely is a risk, and it's not just for reputation, but what also is affected if, you know, one senior or elder said to somebody, this is not a good program, I got hurt, blah, 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 then what could happen?
Yeah, and I also think, like, seniors are definitely the type of demographic that things moved by word of mouth more so than some other age categories. So,
and if you've done a lot of programming and set up a lot of opportunities for, say, a series of fitness programs for that group, this happens early on in your program. Now and people stop coming or start canceling. Now you have a loss of revenue. You have staff in place that don't have the work. You have to reassign them. So there definitely is a level of severity of consequences to that that's not necessarily physical risk. So thanks for raising that. Let's just go to Dana and Kelly and Nadine. Can you think of some consequences other than, say, physical injury or reputation being damaged that might be something that you would consider a risk?
Yeah, for sure. So something that we are very aware of, like especially working with youth, is that like bullying may be happening. Yeah, because kids can sometimes be pretty brutal to each other, and we know like we're sometimes aware of situations that might be going on in other contexts, and so we have to be very mindful of like paying attention to that. More recently, like, we've been in Zoom programming, and so, like, also aware of, like, the potential for cyberbullying to be occurring. We just make sure that on our Zoom, we change our the messaging abilities for everyone to just be messages to everyone so that we're not getting, like, harmful messages, like, private messages going directly from the
Exactly. And that, the bullying and the cyberbullying, that's an example of a larger psychological type risk. So psychological damage is a pretty big thing, right? You know, probably the most evident example that we have in society is residential schools. But there's triggers for people, people who live with trauma. There's all sorts of things that in our programs or our facilities or the people that we use to run our programs can even not consciously but inadvertently lead to some, there's psychological risks there or potential of psychological harm or consequences. So that's a really good example. Thank you for raising that. Lindsay, you've explained the sort of the personal property piece with the passport. Is there anything else that comes to mind with regards to what type of consequences could be in terms of an event, like what might happen that's not physical, psychological, or reputational?
Okay, going at the end is a little harder. I was trying to think of equipment or like our facilities having to be shut down that somebody might normally use. I don't know, I'm really stretching here. No, I don't think I can at this time. Like, I'm struggling here. I think relationship risks, but that's kind of what Eliza and Carly already talked about.
You're right, though, about facilities, right? So there's facility risk. Think of Shipyards Park if we had freezing rain, right? There's a risk. I guess that's physical injury, but think of like the Canada Game Centre, what was it, 10 years or more ago when, you know, some kids lit the ski skating out on
the
fire.
Yeah.
So then there's a, you know, running programming or running a facility do run a risk. There's a risk of damage to your facility as well. So there's different types of risks, and I think we just have to be really aware, and, you know, I'm going to break my back, I'm going to break my hand is the first thing that comes to mind. But, you know, as you pointed out, you know, working with youth, be careful of bullying. There's psychological impacts. There's a damage to your reputation as an organization. There's a personal loss of effects like a passport. There's, you know, damage to a facility. So there's lots of things when we're talking about the probability of something happening and the consequences of that. We need to think that a little bit broader than just physical injury. So that was a great conversation. I think I really thank everybody for contributing to today's discussion, and I'm looking forward, I know some of you have already posted your RLA for Sunday, but I'm looking forward to reading those over the next few days. And then next week what we'll do is we'll explore the remaining two steps in risk management, and you'll actually end up with a bit of a risk management plan. So please try, if you want to look ahead, try and choose something that's really relevant that you can actually use in your work, because this is an opportunity for you to create things that are useful to you and meaningful to you. And it also helps each other learn from that, too. So just to quickly, any questions or anything like that? Eliza, Carly, any questions, other closing comments from you?
No, I think we're good. We were just kind of chatting about like this, you know, the next assignment and trying to think of things that are relevant. So, yeah, anyway, I think we're good.
Yeah, and if you'd like to work on it together, I'm fine with, like, if you guys have something that's a little bit bigger that you'd like to create a risk management plan for together, by all means, go ahead and do that. I'm not sort of, you don't each have to do your own one when you're working as a group, and that's kind of the advantage of having a group. And I think Lindsay probably has different tasks than what you guys have, so I don't know if it would work for all three of you to work together. But definitely you can work together on something. Just if one person submits it, let me know that it's for both of you and that you've both worked on it. And the same applies for Dana, Nadine, and Kelly, and Serena. You guys can pick something if you want to work on something, as long as it's a little bit more substantial and reflects the input of the number of people that are working on it. I'm totally okay with that, too. So, Kelly, Dana, Nadine, any other questions or anything?
No, I don't think at this time.
Yeah, we're good.
Awesome. And Lindsay, any final questions, comments?
No, I don't get. Thank you.
Okay, next time if we have a bigger circle, I'll reverse the order. So thanks for being patient and going last. Okay, well, thanks, everybody. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you next week. Enjoy the sunshine and the long weekend.
Yep. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.